Hello and welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and with me is, dude, I don't have a good reference to the movie here. It's Joel.
You can just call me Science. No, I don't know. I'm just Joel, man.
There wasn't like a good. I couldn't think of a fine. See, I didn't see, there wasn't like a good line or whatever to really pull from.
I'm the mysterious horn player that's all in all Spike Lee movies.
You mean Terrence Blanchard?
If God created anything better than crack cocaine, he kept that shit to himself.
Oh, there you go.
Don't put that one in.
Yeah, so with us is Martin Kessler from the Timbuktu episode.
Hi, thanks welcome. For having me back.
You're welcome. So, I don't think you've been on a few times. Also, Melvin and Peebles episode last year, which is that was a real fun one. Got a little serious, yeah. But got also a lot of fun. But I don't think I ever came up like, are you a fan of Spike Lee? Like, what's your history? Like, can you remember like how you first even heard of Spike Lee? If you can even remember that?
He's an interesting filmmaker, and he's made some films that I really like, and he's made some films that I haven't liked as much. So, you know, he's kind of in that category. But, like, you know, he's definitely somebody I keep track of. And I'm trying to think where I first found out about him or what was the first film I even saw of his. He's such a major figure, like, in American cinema especially, that it's kind of hard not to know who Spike Lee is or, you know, have at least seen some of his films just by, like, stumbling across stuff to see. But I remember the first time I saw Clockers, though. It was in that, like, Spike Lee DVD box set. It had Jungle Fever, and it had a couple of them all kind of packaged together. And unfortunately, that DVD got frozen and cracked at some point, but now I have the Blu-rays, so everything worked out. There's some Spike Lee films I really love, and they're not
Are you a fan of The Sweet Blood of Jesus?
I like it. I like Sweet Blood of Jesus. All right, I'm somebody who might even like his messier films better than like the quote unquote perfect films. Like, he has films that are basically like, oh, that's perfect. And then there's films where I'm like, this is kind of a mess, but it's also kind of great. And Sweet Blood of Jesus is kind of in that category, I think, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
And, of course, like, you know, sort of loosely based on Ganja and Hess, I guess. It's kind of a remake. I guess it is a remake, right?
Yeah. He does credit Bill Gunn. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He does credit Bill Gunn in the credits.
Yep.
Okay.
Sorry.
What are your least favorite Spike movies?
My least favorite?
Yeah.
I mean, I'd have to take a look at the list of stuff he's directed. I don't know, it might feel a little bit rude to like single out one as being like his worst, but it's probably She Hate Me, right?
Yeah, probably, but also has a huge what the fuck factor to it.
Right. I mean, that's kind of what I mean, where like even like Spike Lee at his sort of messiest or worst, it's like still, you know, this sort of swinging for the fences kind of interesting stuff. Oh, you know what? You know what's worse than She Hate Me? His Old Boy remake. That's the worst one. That's gotta be. There. Okay, we figured it out.
Okay. Well, we thought it was just okay and boring. I thought it was kind of boring.
That's what makes it bad, though, is it's just kind of like okay and boring. Like, the fact that, you know, he remade a pretty wild film and made it like dull and uninteresting is kind of the biggest crime of that movie. You know, like, if his Old Boy movie was worse but crazier, I would love it more. But it's the fact that it's just sort of forgettable and... That's another film that had a poster controversy that's a little bit like the one we're going to be talking about.
Yeah, because it looks a little similar to Anatomy of a Murder.
Right. Rip off or homage? That's the question I guess people would ask about that. The old boy controversy with that poster. I forget if you talked about it, but it was basically ripping off poster designer's work and not crediting him and not paying him. But Spike Lee's
has a history
multiple
of
movie poster controversies, I guess.
Yeah, among other controversies. But, so, Joel, had you heard of Clockers? Had you seen it before?
Sure, I heard of Clockers. I hadn't seen it before, no.
But it has your favorite actor in it.
I am aware of that.
It's got my favorite actor in it, too.
Mekhi Phifer is excellent.
He is, like, the... you know Balthazar Getty in... Oh, the David Lynch film. Oh my god, what's wrong with my brain tonight?
Lost Highway,
right. He's got, like, roughly the same amount of charisma as Balthazar Getty in that. So, that's who I kept coming back to. It's, like, my reference point. Mekhi Phifer. He went on to great things, like I Still Know What You Did Last Summer.
I thought he was in Scream 2.
He had, like, a kind of a horror career for a little while. And I feel like he was, like, big in, like, the early 2000s. No, it wasn't Scream. It was I Still Know What You Did Last Summer.
Scream 3.
But he's in Dawn of the Dead, I think.
The remake?
Yeah, the remake, the Zack Snyder one.
I just remember...
Scream 2 is Omar Epps.
Oh, I only saw a movie once. I fell asleep during it.
But I haven't seen him in anything lately. I don't know what. I just know...
All I remember from that remake is Nick Stahl and the rest is and the redhead. Besides those two, it's kind of like, there's nothing there.
In the Dawn of the Dead remake?
Yeah, I've seen
Sarah Pauly, Vin Rames. It actually has a good cast, yeah.
I've seen it like five times, but if you quiz me on it, I could not tell you what happened on it in the movie. It always leaves my brain once the credits hit.
Okay. That's fair.
Did you say Nick Stahl?
Is Nick Stahl even in that? No, he's
not in the movie.
Oh.
In the Dawn of the Dead remake?
Then who's a security guard?
Is it Ty Burrell? Jake Weber?
I have a memory of Nick Stahl being in it.
It's not Nick Stahl.
How did this episode get off the rails so quickly?
Oh,
sorry. Because
we were talking about Mekhi Phifer's career, so we just got distracted.
His career derailed this conversation.
When he said my favorite actor, he was actually talking about Delroy Lindo.
Okay.
For sure. And he's great in this movie.
The cast is fantastic. Harvey Keitel's my favorite actor. Keith David's in this. He's one of my favorite actors.
I was surprised to see Keith David.
It's a really good cast this movie has.
Yeah, Sticky Fingers from Blade, the series. Remember the series Blade?
I'm trying to forget, but... I didn't make that connection, but...
Yeah, the cast, like, when the credits were going on, I was like, okay, Mekhi Phifer, okay, he's fine. And it's like, Dory Lynn, like, okay, this is good. Harvey Keitel, John Turturro, Keith David, is Mike Starr. It just kept going and going, like, and Michael Imperioli, because he has to be in a Spike Lee movie from this time.
Right.
But it's just like, oh, holy fuck, this is an amazing cast. This is my first time seeing it, because it's what I've been holding off on. The cat's trying to get on the table. Go away. I don't know. Watching it now, it's like, okay, this is kind of up there for my favorite Spikes. It's not like
kind of sits right somewhere in my top five. I think, like, it's not my favorite, but I think, like, the cast is a big part of it, and the style, like, that kind of bumps it up into that, like, top five category for me.
Mm. Yeah, and he got game edges this out. I kind of really like He Got Game a whole lot, despite its sexism issues. But, like, But like this is just like right below that. It's like okay, like in the mid '90s, Spike was really, for a brief stretch, was really hitting it out of the park. And I'm not talking about Crooklyn, because Crooklyn, we did have that song, and that's one's a real mess. But I don't think
I actually really love Crooklyn, but yeah, it's a good
love.
those ones are my favorite. It's the kind of like my favorite Spike Lee movie is Bamboozled, and that's definitely a mess, but it's like an amazing mess. And I mean, nobody would want to hear. Like, I wouldn't want to hear myself talk about Bamboozled, and I'm glad I'm on this episode. But you know, like, that type of Spike Lee film is kind of what I gravitate to when I get into his stuff, and like the sort of chances he takes and the boldness, you know, even when it doesn't pan out. Like, there's definitely things I admire, even in the films that I think don't work as well as others.
That is also Spencer's favorite, Spike Lee.
Bamboozled is the best. I
Mine
like.
will continue be the Old Bull remake. No, what?
Is it Malcolm X because of Delroy Lindo?
No,
Malcolm X is pretty great though. Like that's
Malcolm X is great.
Yeah, Mo Better Blues. Ugh. Oh my god,
Hold
I'm
up.
tongue-tied. And like, Do the Right Thing. That's sort of like I don't know
Of
if
School
it
Days?
might strike people as like an
Yes,
obvious
Primary
choice,
School
but like,
Days.
Do the Right Thing is like I wouldn't hold that against like anyone if they said that was their favorite. Like that's a great choice, you know. But like
Yeah.
Clockers almost feels like a sequel to Do the Right Thing in a weird way. Like out of all this stuff, like to me this kind of feels not like not the most similar necessarily. I guess Do the Right Thing kind of did get sort of a sequel spin-off, but like Clockers kind of continues a lot of the issues that get brought up and Do the Right Thing and sort of expands on them and brings them into different territory and kind of looks at them from a different angle. So it feels like the most thematically connected immediately out of Do the Right Thing. And even like, you know, there's the one part where Harvey Keitel's talking to the kid, the Shorty, and you know, he even says like, you want to do the right thing. And it's almost like, you know, the movie could have been called Do the Right Thing too, you know.
Yeah, but
I
you
thought
did that
anyway.
with Red Hook Summer, the best one, you
I
know,
know,
that's a sequel.
I know that Red Hook Summer exists, but like, you know, Red Hook Summer is not really like
That movie's a huge mess. You should know that.
Well, some are not great messes, but I mean, it's weird that like you would make like an actual connected like Do the Right Thing sequel anyway. But like you know how some directors have their thematic trilogies, or you know, the Depression trilogy, or the whatever. Like, you know, Clockers kind of feels like part two in a like a Spike Lee Doing the Right Thing trilogy. I don't know, maybe 25th Hour is like the third part of that trilogy, because
Yeah,
I
that
think
also
that
feels
one.
sort of like, especially the ending of 25th Hour, feels really kind of like a connected to Clockers anyway.
For sure.
And this is a part of, like his, I forgot what you call it, but like his Brooklyn series. It's like Do the Right Thing, Clockers, Crooklyn, He Got Game, Does We Blood Jesus, and Red Hook Summer, I think are his Brooklyn series, and that'd be like one or two I'm forgetting.
Is Summer of Sam set in Brooklyn?
No, that's set
No.
in Bed, no, not Bed-Stuy, Bensonhurst.
Okay.
The Italian neighborhood. That's
Okay.
like.
Miracle in St. Anna, of course.
Yeah.
They're fighting World War II in Brooklyn.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think part of why this movie succeeds is that Spike had a co-writer on it, and when he had a co-writer, it either ended up with like something like Miracle in St. Anna, where it's like nothing about it works, or it's like Kevin Willmott, who he did with the what's that movie, Black Klansman, who like who can like streamline who can help streamline Spike's like tendencies to go everywhere. And like this is a case of like okay, like I forgot the screen co-writer's name, but like he but I feel like the script is like it takes the Spike Lee isms, but it streamlines it in a way that works and is
Well,
not
it's
going to all over the place.
because it's Richard Price, working from his own novel, and like he's you know, gone on to work on The Wire, The Night Of, which is kind of similar, also has John Turturro in it. You know, this sort of like almost feels like a precursor to The Wire in a lot of ways, so you can see the writing connections.
Yes, I felt that the whole time.
And even before Spike Lee came on and got involved with the writing process, it was going to be a Martin Scorsese film. And I think Richard Price also, he might have written The Color of Money, I think. I don't know if that's right. I feel like that's right. But originally Clockers was going to be a Martin Scorsese film. And it, like in some ways that makes a lot of sense. Like Clockers, you know, the way it's a, it could have been a Do the Right Thing too. It also could have been like a Mean Streets too. You know, so like you can see that working, but Scorsese ended up leaving it to go and make Casino instead, and Spike Lee came in and I guess tweaked it, and you could really see his voice in the writing. Like it does come through that he was involved with not just the directing but the writing as well.
One cast member I forgot to mention, the most important one by far, Thomas Jefferson Byrd. Might be my favorite Spike Lee regular.
He's also got a really great death scene in this.
Yeah, and he always brings this like wild card energy where you see his name in the credits. It's like, well, where is he going to be? You have no clue where or when he's going to show up or if he's going to die or whatever. And like he's always big and over the top in the best way. I always want more of him, but more of him would get in the way probably of everything else.
Probably. Right. I mean, he's always flailing his elbows and his arms in a way that he'd probably be giving black eyes to the rest of the cast. And, you know, it's like an insurance thing. He can only be in a little bit of the movie.
It's just the right amount to, like, make the movie heightened without breaking that kind of, like, gritty reality of it. Like, he knows how to play a character who's, like, a little bit over the top without sort of breaking the illusion that this is, like, a real person within the world of the film.
Yeah. Yeah, like he like was a wider connection. He feels like Omar a little bit, minus like the like Robin Hood qualities of Omar. He's like Omar gone bad of like, oh, you know, he's capable of this, like killing someone without even thinking about it. And like it's you get like the flashback briefly, but besides the flashback, there's like no indication of it besides just his weird presence. And what they say about him, and it's like, yeah, I believe this guy is is capable of doing these things.
But he's also a sympathetic character at the same time. Like that's one thing I like about the film too, is, you know, like nobody's really completely a bad guy. I think in this movie, it's sort of people do bad things and they make mistakes and they don't always do the right thing. But it's like, you know, everyone has something sort of sympathetic about them. And, you know, that feels like a conscious choice, but I was even wondering this time around watching, like, the flashback where you see him threatening Delroy Lindo's character, Rodney. Like, do you think that was real, or do you think he was just saying that to get in Strike's head, you know?
I mean, I want to know if it is real, like, the situation where... Because at that point, Delroy Lindo was the newbie who had to be coerced, you know, through violence to kill his first person. And then it's like at some point, Delroy Lindo became the top dog. And, you know, it seems like the other guy just kind of stayed in place and maybe even dropped down because, you know, he's sick.
Yeah, they sort of explain it like he's addicted to drugs and he got AIDS from that and... But, like, he's also talking about, like, oh, you know, I was going to be an accountant or I was studying, like, accounting or something like that, you know. And, you do have a couple of these flashbacks and...
Yeah,
The way they're played, like, I was sort of wondering, like, how ambiguous are they supposed to be? Like, there's sort of an important reveal at the end where, yeah, you could take it as being completely true and it doesn't really affect how you watch the movie. But if you want to go back and second guess, like... You know, is this sort of a Rashomon type situation, maybe? Yeah.
It's a version of the person's memory, whether or not it's exact. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was like, that leads to the question. And in the moment, I assumed, oh, that really happened. But like, now you bring that up, and I'm realizing that it like had the same appearance. It's like, so, I'm not really sure, because like Spike and like that, like he was like the changing of like the appearance of film was like, you know, it's a really like clever. Clever way,
right? You get that like that bleach bypass kind of look where everything's really contrasty and sort of blown out, and especially for those flashbacks he makes it like really grainy, and it looks almost like you know, like all the whites are shifted to yellow, and it's like the 1970s worn out looking kind of style for a lot of that stuff, faded print kind of look to it.
Yeah, and also often the police station looks nice and clean, or our stuff with like Harvey Keitel and Turturro looks notably cleaner and more slick and more you know, like a quote unquote regular movie. At least like when it got to the police station, it really stuck out. Like it looked so much smoother, at least on the DVD I had.
I couldn't see anything in the police station because Totoro was wearing those red pants.
So I was also wondering, you know how there's that scene where they're asking the guy at the restaurant some questions, and Harvey Keitel calls him Jesus, and the guy's like, I pronounce it Jesus. Just call me Jesus. And this was 3 years before Big Lebowski, where John Turturro plays a character named Jesus. I was wondering if this might have inspired that. Because he's right there in that scene, and like, I don't know if Coen Brothers would have watched this and thought that was really funny, or how that might have led to that. But it's just such a weirdly specific connection to have between this movie and The Big Lebowski that I thought that was really funny.
Yeah, and like, I don't know, are Coen Brothers like real cinephiles? Like, do they watch everything?
I would guess. I mean, you know, if you have a regular actor like John Turturro, who's, you know, in a couple of their movies, and he's in a couple of Spike Lee movies, you probably watch at least the movies that your favorite actors are in, you know?
My wife's doing a movie. I gotta watch this one again.
Right, right. Barton Fink's in a new movie. We gotta go see it, even though he doesn't have a lot of lines. I don't know.
You know, that actor. We'll just call him Barton. Hey, Barton. Right.
Yeah. Saw like, John Turturro, like, you know, it's not like the meatiest role he has in this movie, but it's like, oh, he's a Spike Lee regular. Like, you gotta find a spot for him. It sort of feels like he's not bad or anything. It's just like, it's a smaller amount of screen time than what he usually gets.
I mean, I feel like an extension of him from Do the Right Thing. Because he's, again, another racist Italian who keeps calling black people Nubians at every chance he possibly can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, casually calling people brother and stuff like that. Yeah, that's you know, in New York, you could just say that and think you're fine.
Yeah, Joel, did this make you not like New York Italians even more?
I mean, that's not in particular. Like, this didn't. It's nothing's gonna beat those fucking assholes in freaking Summer of Sam. those guys I want to reach to the screen. Like, they were very effective. These guys were just, they're, you know, beat cops, and this was their particular beat. You know, they let some things fly under the wire, they let things other, you know, don't. They're obviously racist, but in the same way that police officers are normally racist.
Like, Harvey Keitel's character, like, the way he sort of apologizes for it, there's another cop who kind of calls him out on it, and he's like, my apologies. And, like, you sort of get the sense that, like, he's been in this system, which is racist, for a long time, that it's kind of rubbed off on him, but at the same time, he's trying to do the right thing at the end of the film, and he's trying to make the right choices and not just, you know, do what the system expects of him. Like, that's kind of his choice as a character that I think is sort of, like, his redeeming act for assuming that Strike must be responsible for the murder. You know, he's like, right away he assumes, because, you know, you have this murder, and one brother confesses to it, but you know that older brother, I think his name's Victor, right? The older brother. Like, yep. You know, he's a family man. He's work, like, you know, he's not. And the younger brother's a clocker, a low-level drug dealer. So Harvey Keitel's character, the detective, assumes it must be the younger brother, and he's going after him. And like, I think he sort of realizes that's his own, you know, prejudices about, you know, not even just a racial prejudice, but just because, like, you know, strikes a drug dealer, but, you know, he sort of realizes at the end that he might be innocent, and that's kind of why he gets him out of the city, I think, and why he's trying to set things right as best as he can, you know.
Yeah. And there's a direct connection to Crooklyn, in that Isaiah Washington plays Victor in Crooklyn, and he plays a Victor in this movie, too. But they can't be the same person, because Crooklyn is period piece, but it's still interesting that they he plays a character of the same name.
Maybe it has a direct connection to Sweet Blood of Jesus, and he's a vampire. Do you ever think about that?
Well,
he could be an immortal.
Well, vampires do exist in the Do Right Thing universe, if you follow the connection.
And Crooklyn takes place in the universe. Therefore,
it's true.
See, I'm telling you.
That means there are vampires and She Hate Me. They're lesbians and vampires.
Maybe little Dieter or whatever his name was a vampire, and he didn't actually die from that fall. He, like, got exposed to the sun.
Yeah, I should explain, because the opening line of The Sweet Blood of Jesus is Bishop Enoch is dead. And so they immediately establish that Bishop Enoch from Red Hook Summer exists in that universe where there are vampires. Which just, like, made me realize, oh, all these movies are connected in a weird way. And you have the Detective Flood guy. It's a whole thing. Yeah. Well, listen to our episode.
This is like St. Elmo's revelation.
Yeah, it goes deeper into that. We recorded the Red Hook Summer episode already, and we get into it a little bit in that episode. Okay.
Well, I was going to say, like, at the very end, after Harvey Keitel lets Strike loose, there's the Nation of Islam guy who comes up selling the paper that's, like, says black and white justice right on it, you know. Truth, it's not as, like, blatant as, like, yeah, it's almost like the, you know, rat at the end of The Departed moment. It's more subtle than that, but, you know, like,
yeah.
It's a CGI newspaper.
No.
You said, like, I assumed that Strike must have done it the whole time. Like, I mean, he did tell his boss did tell him to go do it, and he seemed to be loyal enough, at least at that point. But, like, his character is strange.
It's weird how he's, like, the least likable character in the whole movie, even though he's, like, the main character, and he's the guy that everyone sort of keeps kind of taking falls for. And, you know, his brother, Shorty, like, the, you know, I think there's one part where, you know, Harvey Keitel's telling him, like, oh, you must be some wonderful guy. Everyone's trying to protect your back, you know? Like, what's so great about this guy that other people would go to jail for him or kill somebody to protect him? I don't know, but maybe that's part of the... right. But, you know, like, maybe it's part of the point that, like, this guy's kind of, you know, going around being a drug dealer, and it's like, hey, you know, there are these people giving you a second chance, basically, and, you know, you don't have to do this. So.
I mean, I took him as this, like... it's not subtle at all. Like, he's coded to, like... I'm not sure how old he was, but he did seem like a baby compared to everyone around.
Drinking chocolate milk and playing with trains and video game systems, right? Like, those are things we associate with children. Now, as a grown-ass adult who likes all those things, well, except I don't have a Troy train set. But I understand why somebody might like that. But it's still, in the movie, it's coded as, like, you know, he might as well have a tricycle.
Yeah. And
well,
like,
it's also sort of funny, too. Like, I know when Black Klansmen came out, there were some people I know who were criticizing it for being so sympathetic towards the police perspective and kind of glossing over certain things in that. But I was thinking, like, watching this especially, like, Spike Lee's always been pretty sympathetic to police, like, more than you might expect. And I think, you know, in this movie, it's much more subtle and nuanced and complicated, partly because the writing, you know, the way that cops are callous when they're looking at the dead body and stuff like that. But, you know, like, for a film that is approaching, you know, this, like, complicated systemic issue, like, I think, like, Spike Lee's point of view is pretty sympathetic to the police, who are trying to do a good job and do the right thing. Like, you know, they're not just a total impediment to this person's life, to Strike's life, you know, like, they actually, you know, he gets helped in the end, so.
Things were, like, heating up and, like, Strike was, like, making things worse for himself, I was kind of secretly hoping, because the whole time I felt like 25th Hour a little bit, and as you were saying earlier, and felt like he got game, and I was like, okay, so it's probably going to be a happy ending, but in the back of my mind, I was hoping, like, maybe he gets killed by Errol. I was secretly hoping, like, maybe there'll still be, like, a Spike will not do his cheesy happy ending bullshit that he does a lot. It's like, he lives. Great. And I was kind of just hoping that, it'd just be, like, continue the cycle. But I also do appreciate the uplifting ending, but at the same time, it's like, But I mean, Errol be crazy.
Yeah. Well, like, I heard an interview with Spike Lee from a while ago where he was sort of criticizing, like, a lot of these, like, urban crime films that were coming out in the 90s. You know, sort of, like, I don't think he was pointing it out, but he was, like, referencing stuff like, you know, Menace to Society or films like that. It was a whole genre for a while. And I think, like, this was partly meant to be his response to that. And he talked about wanting the ending to be hopeful and show that there's actually, like, hope for these characters. And it's not just, like, totally pessimistic, downbeat ending, you know. And I, like, it might vary from person to person how much the ending of this rings true or feels kind of, like, overly optimistic or what, but you know, I think that was definitely his intent. I mean, like, thinking about, like, some of the other crime films I like that came out around the same time, like, I don't know if you've seen Nicholas Winding Refn's Pusher.
Oh, and that's been on my list for years.
I think it came out just the year after this, and it's pretty similar in some ways. But, like, that character, the main character in that, who's also, like, a low-level sort of criminal, he gets in, like, way over his head, and in the end, it's basically, like, there's no hope for him. you don't know if he actually escapes or not. Like, it has sort of an ambiguous ending where you're not sure if he gets killed or if he actually runs away. And even in the sequels, they don't really address that. It's sort of left to your imagination, but it's like he's in so deep, you know, there's almost no way out. And I do kind of wonder how Clockers would be if it had a slightly more ambiguous ending about what happens to Strike.
Joel, did you like the ending? Did it work for you?
I thought he was going to die. Honestly,
yeah, I mean,
the cops set him up to die. Like, the fact that he does not get killed after they basically guaranteed he was dead unless he confessed to the murder that I guess he didn't do, it was surprising to me. Like, him getting driven to, you know, not the Port Authority,
Penn Station.
He's driven somewhere. Penn Station. Dropped off at Penn Station, and then we see him on a train, like, what? Looking out the window.
Wait, Angel, you ever been to New York before?
No.
Oh. Huh, that's
nice. I've never been anywhere.
Okay. It's Penn Station. It's real famous.
I live in a basement, and I'm afraid of the outside.
Fine.
I know Penn Station's a real place.
Okay.
I saw it in a book.
Yeah. Yes. I've been there a few times.
Yeah.
But, okay, so...
So, oh, okay, wait, you've been to Penn Station a couple of times. Were you, when you were there, did you see a bunch of people getting second chances?
That's so all packed. He saw.
It was so packed I couldn't tell. But no, we got to talk about Keith David. It was such a surprise to see Keith David in a Spike Lee movie. I never thought I'd ever see that.
This is the only one he's been in, right?
As far as I know, yeah.
I think so. He's great in this. Like, he has that sort of authoritative presence, and, you know, it makes sense he's playing a cop in it, but he's one who's trying to look out for the people around, and I do kind of like when he just lets Strike have it.
Oh, yeah. It's great, because, like, it's Keith David. You're not going to get in the way of him beating someone up, because he will kill you.
Yeah,
and it's like, him, like, he's basically like a local father figure. Because, like, I think all the mothers around you see are single moms. I don't think you ever see a dad active. So he basically has to be the local dad figure. He has to try to keep them in line as much as he can.
Yeah. I mean, when he first, like, I sort of forgot what his relationship was to the Shorty character. But there's, like, one part when I was rewatching it where he's like, oh yeah, go upstairs and see your mom. I'm like, wait, is he his dad? No, he's just actually, like, looking out for him. Oh my, I love the part where Regina Taylor's character comes and she just, like, chews out all the clockers, like, one after another. And she's like, I know your mom, and I, like, you used to live next door to me. Giving these guys a hard time because, you know, they're just, like, sitting around, bumming around, being a bad influence, you know, for her kid who's watching them and kind of wants to emulate them. And, like, that's another thing the film kind of gets into, is just like, people who want to be that gangster criminal, you know, the people who kind of aspire to be that, or, you know, kids who are impressed by that. You know, Shorty's impressed by his gun, and you see him playing that video game, which I guess it's meant to be like a takeoff of Grand Theft Auto or something. It's a little bit
95, so, like, Doom, maybe?
Gangsta.
I'm trying to think what shooters were around. Like, Doom, Castle Wolfenstein. Because,
They had some very crude-looking 3D style games just like that, you know?
Yeah.
You know,
Bubsy 3D? I don't know.
And, like, I mean, the way I took it, like, I think if you take that idea that's introduced in the film as, like, oh, like, video games cause violence, like, I think that's kind of dumb. But I think it, you know, the way I was watching it was more like, you know, the video game, it's part of something that sort of glamorizes a life that's not glamorous at all.
Oh yeah, it definitely felt like just, like, capitalistic, like, taking advantage of, like, this is trendy right now, so let's do make a video game about, like, being a drug dealer in the hood or whatever. Like, it didn't feel like their Spike is saying video games are bad. It just felt like,
right,
it's just like, you know,
I mean, that's what people thought. Like, yeah, they got a Sega Genesis. They're learning how to kill. Yeah, Sonic is teaching these people. Vector Man teaching people how to get their blood. Like, this is like the what a parent imagines a kid actually is playing. When
there was
nothing like it.
At Del Rey Lindo's store, you see a Virtua Fighter arcade cabinet. Man. They're teaching the kids Kung Fu. They're learning.
That's how I learned how to punch people.
they're learning karate and Kung Fu from Virtua Fighter.
Mm-hmm. But, like, you know, I think it's to Spike Lee's credit that, like, all the criminals in this, like, there's no glamour in it at all. Like, it looks actually pretty miserable. And, like, you know, like, in reality, like, the average drug dealer makes less than minimum wage. Like, it's not a, you know, maybe if you're right at the top, you might do okay. But for most people, it's just, you know, a way of getting by, and that's it. And, you know, it's not glamorous. It's not going to make you rich. So, you know, I think that's part of what makes the film feel a little bit more real in its approach to crime, and gives it that kind of edge over some other films that were coming out around the same time, which had, like, a more fantastical kind of approach to gangsters and criminals.
And there's, like, a very vague, like, Drunken Angel connection a little bit, a Strike is coughing up blood, and, like, he clearly has a health issue, and, like, that made me assume, like, oh, he's gonna die. in the same thing of Drunken Angel, where Toshiro is the gangster who's living, you know, that type of life, and like, you know, he will get killed through that living that type of life. And it's like, okay, maybe, and I guess Harvey Keitel would be like the Shimura analog. Oh,
yeah.
But like, yeah, but it didn't go the way that like it was going. And
I could see that. I mean, I know Spike Lee's a Kurosawa fan, but it's funny because like the coughing of blood is usually like the cinematic kiss of death for a character. Like, oh no, he's coughing up blood in the first act. He's gonna be dead by the end. Nobody ever lives through it, but
definitely.
Yep.
Yes.
I was wondering, like I kept trying to figure out, like, I guess it's supposed to be an ulcer, maybe, like from, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I was wondering if the well, like, I mean, stress doesn't really cause ulcers. It's like an infection. You know, people used to think stress caused them, but I was wondering if, like, the milk, the chocolate moo, was somehow making his stomach hurt, like, if it was bad for him somehow. If,
yeah, because there were a lot of time of saying, like, quit drinking that shit. And, like, yeah. He's always, like, yeah. Or maybe, I thought at some point, like, he's lactose intolerant.
Like, yeah, I had that same thought, yeah. Well, and, like, you know, he gets a stomach kick, and then, like, right away goes to drink it, and, like, the way he's always carrying it around, I sort of thought maybe there was a connection, and then, like, my mind went to, like, oh, is there a connection between, like, I don't know, drugs hurting somebody, and then, like, that's immediately, like, what you go to try to solve the pain, and that's only making it worse. Like, I had some weird... I was trying to figure out, like, if there was, like, a significance to the chocolate milk, and I was wondering if it was supposed to be, like, a drugs metaphor, or maybe it's just a weird detail in the movie, I don't know.
Is he supposed to be like, he's supposed to be like a baby? Like, is he like, is he not 21 yet?
Like, I think probably not, because like, I thought like maybe he's even a teenager still, because he's not supposed to be drinking, right?
Right,
he graduated high school,
or he does get a drink. Okay, so he must be 21.
But it wasn't. Okay. He didn't order the drink. The guy just kind of put it up on the bar for him. So who knows?
Because all those blockers he hangs out with, they all seem like they're like 18, 19 kind of age.
Yeah, and like I've got the feeling like he, like, because like he's a baby, like he, it seemed like, and they never talk about women, or you never see him with a woman. So it's like, is he supposed to be like a virgin? Like he literally is like stuck in like that childish mind space. Like he hasn't experienced anything outside of like living in that, like, exile, like selling drugs.
Yeah, no idea.
I just googled, it looks like Mekhi Phifer was 21 when the film came out, so yeah, that's probably what the character's meant to be, around that age.
But with the Spike movies of the 90s, minus Malcolm X and Crooklyn, there's always a mention of like the mayor and like New York politics, because like in mm-hmm. Jungle Fever, you have like the Italian racist guys complaining about like Dinkins is there, and then John Turturro's character like, well, you sure vote for Giuliani, and like in this movie, like the racist cops say, hey, Dinkins is out, so that means you Nubians, blah blah blah, and we got Rudy, and it's like, oh, okay. Spike has to throw in like the New York politics. It's just
ongoing commentary.
Yeah, and David Dinkins was the only black mayor of New York City, in case no one knew that. And he wasn't so great, crime-wise. It was still not so, still kind of a shithole when he was mayor.
But I thought Rudy Giuliani saved the city.
Quote-unquote, he did.
Okay, cool.
He cleared the streets of the homeless. Where did they go? Somewhere.
Remember Keith David being in Roadhouse?
Yeah, his scene was cut. Apparently,
that's a version of Roadhouse I'd be excited to see.
Yeah,
he's a bartender in one scene, but he had more stuff that's cut out.
Oh, okay.
Which is a fucking waste. It's Keith fucking David. You gotta keep him in there.
Yeah,
you know, he's basically confirmed he is not in any other Spike Lee movie.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen. I feel like their politics are different.
Oh, sorry.
Keith David and Spike Lee.
Yeah.
Is Keith David?
I don't know.
Conservative.
I mean, he does, you know, he did a bunch of those military thing, voiceover things. Like, I don't know if that necessarily means that he is pro-military, but that's what you usually tend to think when people take those jobs.
So he does a lot of voice acting in general, though. Like, he's got so many credits.
That's true. He's also pro-Gargoyle, and...
well, like, They Live, you know, like, They Live is not a conservative movie at all.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, that's when he was trying to figure it out. Maybe that's what set him out. He's like, you know, those damn aliens are right.
They have a point.
It really is all about the money.
Yeah, but he has an amazing voice, so... Yeah,
I have a feeling like it just be his voice, but...
Yeah, how'd you get the beans above the Frank?
Wait. Oh, I forgot you said that.
He's got a couple of lines that I remember from being younger. That's one of them. The other one I remember is like, why don't we just like shoot 100,000 nukes at them? Or I can't remember what movie that is. Maybe it's Armageddon. I think he's in that, right?
Oh, it could be.
Tom Schreckenberg should have played the Joker at some point. Because he would have been the best Joker, because he has that crazy energy, wild card factor to him. He would have been the best Joker.
He's more of a Two-Face.
Just give him like a comic book villain so people know who he is, so he can get more movie stuff. But he's in his 70s now, so I don't know if he even wants to do that. Cause he's like he's a Broadway guy. He's like, he has won a Tony or been nominated for a Tony. So...
Wait. Movie he was saying he was supposed to be an accountant, and then he's the guy in Red Hook Summer, right? In the basement.
Yes,
And he's talking about the stock market in that one. Same character. He survived the gunshots.
he became a
hardcore Christian.
Yeah, and then he became a preacher to a vampire, and he married two vampires. He did the ceremony and just replied Jesus when they got married.
Yeah.
Okay, no one said anything. I thought I was going crazy.
No, it's good. I had to mute it because my cat was doing something, so.
Okay. What else is there? Early on, when you first see Delroy Lindo show up, and he has a chat with him, talking about, like, a dream he had. Like, and, like, God told him, like, Strike was, like, you know, the best of his children. That scene, it felt like a truncated version of the Bobby and Major Briggs scene in Twin Peaks. Major Briggs is telling his son about a vision he had about, like, their future. Not as sweet, but like, it did have a type of tone to it.
I mean, one thing I really like about Lindo's performance in this is, even though he's playing like a guy running a bunch of druggies, basically, like, he sounds like the voice of reason for most of it. You know, not to, that like he is necessarily, but that's how he plays the character. He plays him as if like he's absolutely correct in what he's doing. And like, one of my favorite bits is when he's talking to those kids and he's like cutting the hair and just laying things out. And like, on one hand, he sounds very reasonable, but if you look at it from another perspective, it's like, oh, he's kind of like grooming these kids to sell drugs for him at a certain point. And you kind of get that he's probably been doing this. Yeah, you know, there's like Mekhi Phifer's kind of like mouthing what he's going to say to them before. You know, it's like word for word, he's heard this all before. So like, it's a really interesting character, actually, where, like, I don't necessarily think he's, like, a bad guy, but, like, it's an interesting dichotomy between somebody who seems, like, very fatherly and caring, and he's also kind of exploiting these kids.
Yeah, and, like, he called himself a good businessman the whole time, and, like, there's that scene where he talks about, there's, like, the crack addict that he sees, and he's like people like her will keep me in business, because like, no matter what, they're gonna keep coming back. And it's like, Jesus Christ, this guy is the fucking worst. Yeah. But he's such like a fatherly presence to like to these people who, you know, who don't really have a, like, a parental presence in their life. And so, like, and you understand, like, he is, like, of all the characters, he sounds the most logical of everyone. Yeah. Cause, like, the cops are racist, you know, Keith David, you know, he's, you know, to the children, he sounds like this, a boring adult telling him what to do. And, like, this is, like, the one guy is, like, you know, who's telling him, like, no, you can't sell drugs, it's okay. And, like, yeah, you know, he's just, it's so complicated, and, like, I can't picture anyone else besides Dario Lando playing that type of character.
But I feel like that's the kind of, that sets the tone for the whole film, where it's saying, like, yeah, these issues are complicated and nuanced, and it's not good guys and bad guys, cops and robbers, it's real people trying to navigate a really complex situation. And, you know, that's kind of the film's takeaway. Like, even though it does have that optimistic ending, like we mentioned, it does go one step past that, and it ends with the body of, it's science, right?
Yeah, scientific.
Pardon me.
Yeah, your boy from Blade the series.
You know, but it's like, you know, how you have the body earlier in the film that kind of sets everything in motion. It's like, okay, scientific's dead. This is all going to start over again, basically, like looking for a killer. And look, like, it's going to, everything that you just saw in the movie is going to happen over again. And this just happens periodically, and it's,
yeah, and Spike,
you know,
Lee,
it's hopeful,
there,
the ending. Like, Spike Lee does give it a, you know, hopeful ending, but it's not so hopeful to say that everything is solved and it doesn't wrap everything up into a neat little bow, because it's going to say, you know, this will happen again.
Yeah. And Spike Lee cameos as, and Chris as Chucky, and I guess he's a construction worker or something. He just likes to watch the police investigate bodies, and that's all. That's like, I don't know if it's a commentary or anything, but like I appreciate this over other Spike Lee cameos where he has like less
role in the movie. Like this, yes, like really does feel like a cameo. Like, you know, he's only in two scenes, and it's just basically, you know, a brief interaction, seeing the body, and it's not like a big part or anything. I do like him a lot in Crooklyn, though.
Yeah, he gets to be over top and crazy in Crooklyn.
I know. When he gets hit on the head and he's just so unfazed, but he's like, oh. But no, like, I feel like this is like the right amount of cameo for a director to have in their movie.
Okay, what about Mookie and Dude Right Thing? Do you think that's too much Spike Lee? Or do you think that's just enough?
That's just enough. That works. That works.
Okay. Joel, but, do you have any thoughts on, like, Spike's like cameo / acting?
No, I mean, I like him just fine.
Have you seen... we don't have that much left, so we've kind of seen most of it already.
Yeah.
And, like, I've seen some people, well, really don't like it. Like, I am fine with it, even in Jungle Fever, because he has, like, two or three scenes at the most. So I'm pretty okay with it in general, even though I don't know.
I mean, this movie sort of feels, like, too jam-packed to have him have, like, a bigger character anyway. Like, this movie's pretty... full. Like, I was noticing the editing, it feels like somebody trying to cut a 3-hour movie down into 2 hours a lot of the time, where, like, you know how they say, well, you shouldn't really start a scene with somebody walking in the room and end the scene with somebody leaving the room. This film kind of takes that to the extreme, where it's like scenes just like jump right into each other, like very quickly. And even, you know, there's like a scene with Strike and Shorty, and then it cuts to like another scene with Strike and Shorty, and like there's no filler, but it's two different scenes. Like, there's some kind of a time jump, and like, you know, it feels it's not enough to like take the movie down, but I thought it was sort of noticeable that it feels like the movie was like, we really got to work to fit all this into 2 hours. I don't know if you guys felt the same way, but like, it's not like fast paced movie, like it takes its time, but the scenes are very abrupt sometimes.
Yeah, I can see that. This is set in the same universe as Bamboozled, because this is introduces the bomb malt liquor that you see a couple times.
Yeah. So is that separate from the Do the Right Thing universe?
That takes too much thinking right now. Just to go through all the connections, see if it connects. But we're not gonna get into that. There's too much thinking right now.
the bomb ads are pretty funny, and just like Spike Lee's drinking on one when they first show up at the beginning. But like, I don't, it's like one slightly goofy touch in a movie that's mostly pretty grounded.
Yeah.
But I don't mind it, because, like, it's better than just having, like, blatant product placement or something, you know?
Yeah, and, a weird thing that I was trying to piece together, like, why I was there, was when Strike goes to the bar to see Victor, they cut in, like, the music video they're watching, that's on the TV, with him going in a bar and him talking to his brother. And I guess it's like this, is that just like commenting on like hip hop and like glorifying like being like being a clocker and a drug dealer? That's commenting on. Because like the lyrics didn't.
Yeah, I think that's it, yeah.
Because the lyrics, like I was paying attention to the lyrics, they didn't really fit like thematically what they were talking about outside of like outside of like Strike as a. Is a clocker and his brother.
Right, right. It goes the music video, the video game. Like, yeah, you know, he's taking this kid under his wing, like showing, like, oh yeah, if you want to make money, this is the way to do it, kind of thing. Yeah, it is trying to glorify it, or at least he's showing the media, whatever media around there is showing it as being something to it, aspire to.
There's also in the film, there's a lot of use of music with lyrics. In scenes with people talking, which is sort of unusual. It didn't really bother me. It wasn't to the point where it was distracting, really, but like it was sort of an unusual choice where you don't usually see music with lyrics over top of like dialogue scenes. Like that, yeah. You know, the way he had it play, but.
Yeah, and what was it? I really like Turturro's fashion throughout this because he dresses very loudly and obnoxiously, which really fits his character, being the typical like racist cop stereotype that you would expect. And he wears like this like gaudy yellow suit jacket at one point, and it's like who wears that? That's just, it looks so fucking ugly. And really sticks out, and just like it just totally, it just like to me it's just so perfect, with like everything that character is. It's like loud, irritating, and ugly.
Yeah. Do you guys have a favorite scene in the movie?
Has to be either the introduction of Thomas Jefferson Bird, because that was a crazy intense scene where he doesn't blink the whole time. Or Keith David beating up Mekhi Phifer.
I like the Keith David beating him up scene too. I really like the scene though where, like Keith David right before that when he comes in and he's talking to Harvey Keitel's character about Shorty, and he's just like, you know, Tyrone's never done a bad thing. Like you understand what I'm asking you to do right now to basically get him off the hook. And Harvey Keitel goes in and he gives him that story, basically, or it tells him, like, what version of events he should repeat. And, like, it'll cut to, like, Harvey Keitel kind of talking right into camera. And, like, that also feels very 25th hour. But he basically tells the kid everything to say for when he turns on the tape recorder so that he doesn't get into trouble. You know, and he's still going to go to like juvie probably for 2 years or something like that, but they mention at the end, but he's going to keep him out of jail basically. And I just like how that whole scene was handled and how that was shot and the performance, of course. And
do you think the kid was a good actor?
He's fine. He's a kid. I'm
okay, Joel, you're a stickler with kid actor performances.
He doesn't have much to do, so it's. Yeah. I think he does fine for the role, you know. But he's not required to do any super emotional scenes or anything like that. He just kind of, you know, he's a quiet kid who tags along. He's more like a prop, you know, for the mom to come out and confront all the clockers out there. I think that's
he does one bit of good acting in that scene where, like, the mom's crying and he just, like, goes and wipes her tear away when she's asking, like, is my son going to go to jail? And it's like, you know, I don't even know if that was direction or if he did that on his own or what, but, like, I thought that was actually a good bit of child acting.
For sure.
And, like, and this carries on, this movie carries on the Spike Lee thing of identity and names that shows up in, it feels like all of his movies, basically, maybe Mice Old Boy, have, like, a thing with, like, identity and names, and that really comes up in the scene where the mom is chewing out all the clockers, and she's, like, saying what their real names are, and she says, like, one guy's name is, like, Percy something. It wasn't Percy, but it was some, like, kind of lame-sounding name, and it's like, yeah, like, they're not called, like, Strike. They have a government name that sounds like a ridiculous.
Whatever. But what was Strike's real name? Ronald?
Ronald Dunham.
Yeah, like, you know, it makes a difference.
Yeah. Like, that makes me think of Method Man. His real name is Dexter.
Okay, Dexter, it still kind of sounds badass. I don't know if it's because there was that TV show now, but
I always think of Dexter's Laboratory, so to me it's a nerd name and will never change.
I guess, like, Point Dexter or, yeah.
Yeah. Joel, is there anything else? Like, any favorite moments?
But it's got an X in it. Dexter.
That is true. There were Lindo scenes. Are your favorites?
I mean, no. My favorite scenes are the mom yelling at the guys scenes. I mean, Devil Orlando is good the way he is in any movie. He is basically,
although,
just,
if you're going to threaten somebody by putting a gun in their mouth, don't make sure that gun is also pointed at your crotch because you have their head on your lap. Like, that wouldn't work. When he's threatening him in the car,
yeah.
Like, I'm like, you know, if I was in that position, I'd be like, he's not gonna pull the trigger.
At that, you know, once you have a gun in your mouth, you don't really have time to think about the position.
Sure, sure, but it's
not a game of chess.
I just got this image in my head of, like, if you tried to do that in real life and shot somebody, you would just, like, shoot your dick off.
Yeah, probably.
Well, then you can claim self-defense.
It feels like West Indian Archie from Malcolm X 2 a little bit, like the same trajectory, except there's no redemption, which in the book, the autobiography of Malcolm X, that is in the book, the redemption of Malcolm X does return to West Indian Archie, although in the movie it seems like a smolty, cheesy Spike Lee thing. It did happen in real life, apparently. But I don't know, like, I can't remember when we had Wendy on, and, like, I think she brought up that Del Orlando kind of always plays, either people like cops, or people like Rodney Little. And, like, this is kind of fits into, like, the typical thing he always does, but he's really good at. So, like, I can't really complain that much. But, like,
yeah. I mean, he plays a scientist in at least one movie. The Core.
Oh yeah, and, yeah. They drill the Earth.
Yep.
You need that unobtainium.
It was probably a situation like with Mark Wahlberg doing The Happening, where he's like, I want to play a scientist for once.
He's in Romeo Must Die with Jet Li, which is pretty cool. Although he does play one. He plays a similar character, but yeah, if you want to see Jet Li break somebody's spine, that's the movie.
Wait, he's in Romeo Must Die with Jet Li, and he's also in The One with Jet Li?
Oh, I guess he probably is.
That's funny.
Oh, and we get Spike Lee cam at 1 hour 43 minutes in with Strike.
Yeah, I didn't really get that one. Usually, I feel like he picks moments where, like, things are being realized, or, you know, a character is, like, ready to have,
the
like,
bicycle
a changing moment.
Better.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's so brief, too. I think it might be the shortest Spike Lee cam that we've seen so far.
That one's unusual, the one Mekhi Phifer is on, because not only... Usually it, like, holds it, and then it cuts to a different shot, but this one actually, I think, like... Doesn't the camera turn to, like, show what he's heading towards?
Yes, it does.
I think so, unless I was drunk, which I often am. Yeah,
but the camera wasn't on him the whole time, so it did feel weirder. It's like, camera was... like, I guess it, technically a shot went on longer, but wasn't focused on him. On a person for a whole time. But still, yeah, it's kind of like... sort of save it for another scene, probably. Mm-hmm. Or another character. Like, I think it would fit Tom Stretch and Bird, because, like, if he's getting high, you can show him getting high with the Spike Lee cam.
But I like the Shorty on the Bike one, because it's, like, he's coming towards his destiny, basically. Like, that one makes a little bit more sense to me.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, and I did not expect him to shoot him, either. That might be the most shocking thing I've seen in a Spike Lee movie.
A kid shooting somebody?
Yeah, I did not expect him, the kid, to shoot Errol at all.
Come on, Spencer, they're learning it from video games like Gangsta and Virtual Fighter. Like,
but that's the first time
they've been programmed.
But that's like I think the only time you see someone get shot in like real time in a movie. That's not a flashback or a fantasy.
Right. Oh, those like shots in the beginning of the movie of actual, you know, people dead with the gunshot wounds. That's how many of his movies have stuff like that?
Like a lot of them do use like documentary type materials incorporated in, so like that does kind of fit in with his sort of going back and forth between fiction and documentary stuff.
And it feels like and the whole thing with The Wire, it feels like The Wire. I think one of the guys is in The Wire. Can't remember which one, but one of them looks like, I think the guy in The Wire who had the fish collection, like the old pet fish, and he instructed like Wallace to feed them or whatever from season one. Never mind, you guys don't know what I'm referring to.
I don't. Maybe I know who Wallace. I know who Wallace is. I don't remember who had the fish collection.
I think it was Wallace had to take care of the fish, or maybe Dee.
So what? Yeah,
someone had to take care of the fish. That's not important. But I also got vibes of Bad Lieutenant a little bit with the ending, with like him driving to the Penn Station, except it's not depressing. Where like, and I won't spoil Bad Lieutenant for people who haven't seen it, but like it visually kind of feels like it a little bit with like driving to a destination, and yeah, it goes a different way. And also I just like just showing the different types of black masculinity, because you have like the gangster stuff, and then you have Keith David, who's like the more positive, realistic, where it's not glamorous. It's like, you know, he has a normal job and stuff, but like it's not harped on that much, like the differences, but they are there.
There's also Vincent, who, you know, working two jobs.
Oh yeah, true. I kind of forgot
his kids. And yeah, like standing up, those people that it like stands up to for the people he works for. It's like he never has to raise his voice. He never has to, you know, threaten violence or anything like that. And he was still somebody they, you know, respected.
So, okay, so I am wrong then. Like, you do get, like,
the... Do you guys want to go eat at Ahab's? Because this sounds disgusting.
Oh, it does. But, yeah, but you do get the different types of, like, black masculinity and, like, father figures and stuff like that, which... at least there's one character who, you know... So I was wrong, too. There was one character who was a dad who you do see with his kids. It's very brief, but like it is there.
Right. It took going to prison for him to finally get to see them. Because he's complaining right. that he never gets to see them.
That's true.
Because I guess, yeah, because, you know, child care in America is not such a big thing, so you kind of have to work a shit ton of jobs to
but,
afford.
Like, that point is still definitely there, that even though, like, yeah, Vincent's kids have a father in their life, like, he's working so much he never gets to see them, you know, he might as well be absent, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I like this movie a lot. I said earlier, like, Peacock Game edges it out just barely for me. But, like, I was really surprised. Because, like, I never really heard anyone talk about this one. It just gets kind of overlooked. Like other Spike Lee movies. But, yeah, like, I... but not surprisingly, this one was not a big moneymaker. But most of his movies aren't in general to begin with. So, yeah, this is streaming places. The DVD and Blu-ray are out there. And
yeah, there's a brand new Blu-ray. Yeah.
Yep.
And, yeah, Clockers is really great. And I kind of wish seeing this, like, I kind of wish, like, he and Scorsese would work together again on something. But I don't know if that'll ever happen again.
I think, like, that situation might have just been a little bit of a fluke because of Scorsese originally being attached to the project and already having, like, put some effort into getting it developed. That I don't actually know how involved Scorsese was in, like, the final version of the film. So, like, I don't know. Maybe he addressed that somewhere or they talk about it, but, like, also... when Scorsese was working on it, it was going to be Robert De Niro in the Harvey Keitel role, which sort of surprised me because I thought, like, you know, when you hear that it was going to be a Scorsese film, the one thing you picture being, like, pretty much identical is Harvey Keitel in the role and his performance. Yeah. You know, like, that would be completely unchanged. But I think, like, Harvey Keitel is probably better for this role than De Niro would have been.
Yeah, I mean, I think Harvey Keitel's a better actor overall than...
I feel like, for me, like, Harvey Keitel's my favorite actor, and I think, like, in terms of skill, he's probably about the same as De Niro, but I think Harvey Keitel just, like, takes chances that De Niro wouldn't necessarily, like, that's sort of what sets them apart a little bit for me.
Yeah. I mean, like, young De Niro did, because he did 1900, that movie?
Right.
Whatever... Where he's, like, naked in bed with, like, Gerard Depardieu with a woman.
Right.
And, like, their dicks are flinging.
That's true.
And, like...
De Niro used to do that more. And I think, like, as De Niro became, like, more of a movie star, he kind of took on those types of chancier roles less.
Yeah.
Like, and Harvey Keitel, you know, it's hard to picture, like, Robert De Niro doing, like, a bad lieutenant, you know what I mean? Or even just,
yeah.
Like, one example I always think of for myself is, have you seen The Duelists? The Ridley Scott film?
No, that's his first movie, right?
Yeah. Like, you look at Harvey Keitel in that, and you try to picture Robert De Niro doing the same thing, and it's like, impossible, you know? Hmm. Even if you compare, like, another Robert De Niro period film, like The Mission or something.
Yeah, I was gonna say The Mission, yeah.
Yeah, watch Harvey Keitel's performance in that, and it's like, oh, you'd never see Robert De Niro hold his hand like that, even though it's right for the period. Or, you know, like, there's just, like, weird little differences where you sort of say, like, oh, yeah, like, you know, it makes sense Harvey Keitel would be the one to go and do The Piano or, you know, do films like that. It's like, you know, not so much the ability as, like, just the kinds of risks he takes. And that's one thing I really like about him as an actor, you know. Like, he was just in a film... I guess it hasn't gotten a wide release yet, but I saw it at the TIFF Film Festival called The Painted Bird. And he was playing, like, a Czech priest in it. And, like, you know, he'll just, like, take a role like that and, you know, he'll play, like, an Italian detective and, like, he won't do an accent or, you know, like, he'll just throw himself into a role and kind of, like, bring the movie more to him, you know what I mean? So that's one thing I really like about him.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm guessing you would recommend this, Martin?
Sure, like you said, I don't think it's as popular as a lot of other Spike Lee movies seem to be, but I think it's right up there. Like, you know, if I was going to recommend somebody getting into Spike Lee, this might be like the second one I'd recommend people checking out, you know, after maybe, I don't know, Do the Right Thing, check out Clockers, or check out, you know, maybe Malcolm X or Crooklyn. Like, you know, to me it feels like as essential as a lot of his best stuff, so I would definitely recommend it, you know, maybe even to people who like have seen Spike Lee films and haven't liked them that much. You know, if you want to keep taking a chance, like this might be a one to get you into them, actually, because, you know, it'll make you appreciate, I think, what he's going for as a filmmaker, and, you know, at least the sort of chances he takes and the things he tries for.
J-Dog, do you like this movie?
Yeah, I like it. I like it. I think it's good. It's on the upper half of his stuff. It's not in my top five of his things, just because as a whole, I don't know how much of like a remember, you were trying to think of a line from the movie in the beginning, mm-hmm. when you were trying to introduce me. Like, I kind of feel like that's the way the movie is. Like, it's a good narrative kind of murder mystery thing, and great actors all around and stuff like that. But I'm not sure if I'm going to be like, oh yeah, I really want to watch Clockers again. Not because I don't like it, but just because, you know, it doesn't have any of the crazy things that Spike's more unusual movies have that make me go like, yeah, I really need to see that scene again. Or any of his prestige, you know, Malcolm X is like, well, you have to watch that, right? So, like, I think it is very good, and if somebody hasn't seen it, they should watch it. But, you know, yeah.
That's fair.
And, I forgot. Next episode, me and Joel will be talking about Underground, the can winner. Because fuck Mel Gibson, I don't want to watch Braveheart. And
you know who's a big Mel Gibson fan?
Who?
Spike Lee.
Really?
Yeah. Apocalypto is one of his favorite movies.
I mean, Apocalypto is pretty good.
Apocalypto is pretty amazing.
I just don't like the man. I don't like the man himself. You know.
I was watching like, it's funny you mentioned it. Like, I was watching an interview with. Mm-hmm. Spike Lee talking about Clockers when it was coming out, and he was like listing all these like other filmmakers he admires. He's like, oh yeah, Mel mm-hmm. Gibson. Like, he like generally likes Mel Gibson. You know, I would honestly like, yeah, Mel Gibson's a dickhead. I would love to see a Spike Lee film with Mel Gibson. Maybe not as like the lead, but as like the mm-hmm. race cop or whatever. Like, I think that would actually be a good matchup. I would be happy to see Mel Gibson mm-hmm. in a Spike Lee movie. I don't know if that'll ever happen, but
I think the politics side of things will stop that from happening.
I wonder. I wouldn't be surprised if Spike Lee would ever cast somebody like Mel Gibson, but
I don't think he'll ever work with Isaiah Washington again, or at least for a while, because he recently he voted for Trump, or he's a big Trump guy. So yeah, so I don't think that's
gonna... The one I always wondered about is like. Like, you know, he was going in so hard criticizing Tarantino's mm-hmm. films, and like Samuel Jackson, you know, he was in a lot of Spike Lee films, he was in a lot of Tarantino films. I was, you know, talking to Marcus Pinn, I was saying, like, do you think Samuel Jackson's like the kid going back and forth between the divorced parents when he does films for both of them? Like, that's the actor I would most be curious to know about. Like is it awkward after like Spike Lee just trashed Hateful Eight for you to show up on set for Chirac? Like, what's that like the first day on set for that? Do you just not talk about it? What, I don't know. I would love to know. That's a conversation I would love to hear.
I mean,
they don't talk about it.
Maybe they do. I don't know.
They had a falling out for a long stretch, though. So maybe I don't know. But Underground, the Greek movie, I can't remember. Yugoslavian something. It's from like Kessler's part of Europe, I think. I can't remember where it's from.
I think it's Kusturica, the director. It's yeah. Yugoslav.
Okay.
I think it's a Serbo-Croatian movie.
Okay, yeah. That wasn't a slight at you. I just could not remember where this movie is even from. And there's a DVD out there that's pretty cheap. And I think it's on... you didn't hear it from me. It might be on Daily Motion still, in parts. And I think on YouTube, in parts. So
I just heard it from you.
I found okay. Kirkland and Clockers both on YouTube, but they were like... Somebody did the YouTube thing where they... make a picture and just put the movie in a tiny corner.
Oh yeah.
But I just thought it was funny when I was like searching on YouTube to try to find interviews or stuff about Spike Lee from around that time.
Yeah.
And my brain no work now. Martin, do you have other 1995 movies you would recommend?
Sure. Actually there's two. Would that be okay to recommend?
Go for it.
The first one, it's called Ulysses Gaze, and it also stars Harvey Keitel. And it's really, really fantastic Greek film by Theo Angelopoulos. It's about a Greek-American filmmaker going back to look for lost footage. And it's a surprisingly sort of mysterious and emotional film. You know, it's slower paced, I think... It's partly dealing with like the collapse of communism. It was really, really poorly received in America when it first came out. Like I think like Ebert trashed it.
That means it's good though.
But it's great. Like it's a masterpiece. You know, so if you want to see like some of Harvey Keitel's best acting in this like Greek art house extravaganza, that's like it's a little bit like Tarkovsky's Nostalgia. It's that kind of a film. Definitely go check that out to see more Harvey Keitel acting. The other film I'd probably recommend is Catherine Bigelow's Strange Days, which I think that's her best film. And it's also sort of dealing with crime and racial prejudice and systemic problems, but in a sci-fi context, you know, it sort of uses science fiction to deal with some similar issues. And it's just one of the coolest films you'll ever see. It's really, really great. What was the... Detroit. Catherine Bigelow made the Detroit film a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Like, I was so disappointed when I saw that because I was like you made a vastly inferior version of a film that you did 20 years ago that was, like, much more nuanced and thoughtful. You know, Strange Days, like, that's her big kind of sci-fi political crime movie. This sort of, you know, it's set in the film was made in the 90s, but it's set in Los Angeles, like right before, like right at New Year's of 2000, and it's about this technology that I guess it records your memories, your sensations, everything you experience, and it lets people play them back. And it's got Ralph Fiennes, Angela Bassett, Juliette Lewis, Michael Wincott. Like it's. Great cast too, and I don't know, it's like one of the best films from the 90s, so people should check that out.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's got a screenplay by Jay Cox, who frequently worked with Scorsese, so there's another Clockers connection.
Okay. And this will come out actually in a couple weeks from the recording. And this is April, this will mid-April, so this will be around the time we do our Ivan Dixon episode with Marcus Penn on The Spook Who Sat by the Door, which I'm really looking forward to watching that movie again, and Nothing But a Man, which was allegedly one of Malcolm X's favorite movies. So after 95, we're doing 2012 with Red Hook Summer, which we record already, because I don't have to watch that movie again. Perfect. And
well, Joel, it's more Mookie.
And Amanda, WMS Liberty on Twitter will be on for Michael
Haneke.
He says it like Hanukkah.
Hanukkah. Yep.
What I don't know.
Say Haneke.
Whatever. That's depressing movie. I assume it's depressing because it's
Hey, Haneke. That's one of his least depressing movies.
Wait, it's going to be more uplifting than The White Ribbon?
It's slightly more uplifting than The White Ribbon. I promise you.
As long as they don't have one of those awkward scenes where somebody is just, you know, that erection, it's just not going to happen, lady.
No, it's not like The White Ribbon where that ends and it's like, by the way, all those kids grew up to be Nazis.
I thought you were referring to the doctor in his child scene.
Oh.
Was it a doctor?
Which one? The scene I was talking about?
Yeah, the scene where a doctor is with his daughter and the son walks in.
Oh, I thought it was a nurse. It was the doctor and the nurse that he's like, I'm sorry, your face is just too ugly or something like that. What is going on?
Oh, the movie's full of uplifting stuff. Great movie.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, Amour's not quite as soul-crushing, no.
Okay, that's good to hear.
Mm. It's Gargoyles season 1 through, well, there's only one season.
Yeah, you got to HBO Spawn to get some more Keith David.
Oh, yeah, man. I've already seen all those. I could tell you.
All right, and Martin might be coming back for Talai, a great African movie, or I might go on his podcast to talk about it. I don't know yet. The schedule...
We'll talk about it.
Yeah.
And people will hear it.
It will happen at some point, just... The home stretch is kind of packed with a whole bunch of stuff.
Mm.
Yeah, there's lots to look forward to in the next little while.
Yeah, and there will be an episode on Beyond the Lights, because I switched out another special episode, because that's on Netflix. So,
cool.
Yeah, and I just want to watch a movie. So that's it. See you guys next time for Underground.
Underground.
And thank you for coming on, Martin.
Thank you for having me.
Alright, I'm stopping.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell. And thank you for listening.